Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. Memorial Day brings into sharper focus our respect and gratitude for our men and women in uniform and the sacrifices, including the ultimate sacrifice they have made in our behalf. For far too many veterans, their needs in returning to civilian life are ongoing. The transition is difficult. Many feel forgotten as they struggle with health and emotional issues, difficulty finding jobs, and sometimes traumatic fallout that will be a part of their lives forever. StoryCorps, the independent project that collects and compiles the stories of our lives, is assembling the narratives of veterans to be archived and for airing on NPR, and it's been collecting stories in our area. I'm Don Marsh. We'll be talking about some of those stories today and about the issues facing returning veterans. With me in studio, Ryan Barrett is the interim director at the University of Missouri St. Louis Veterans Center. Tracy Carpenter Bond is the St. Louis Community College Veterans Affairs Coordinator. She and Ryan are both veterans. Deborah Marshall is the Veterans Programming Coordinator for the Missouri Humanities Council and director of the Warriors Arts Alliance, which encourages veterans to express themselves through writing and photography. She worked with StoryCorps during its visit here. I want to thank you all so much for being with us. Nice to have you. Ryan, let me begin with you, and I'll really put the same question to each of you because I want to get the answer from each of your perspectives. Ryan, what do you see as the greatest challenge facing veterans as they return home?
Well, I would break it down into two broad categories. First of all, we're looking at veterans who are coming back and they're having trouble finding work. As of right now, the latest numbers show from the Department of Labor that the average post 9/11 veteran has a higher unemployment rate than the national average. So that's number one. Luckily, we have some great education programs that are provided by the Department of Veterans Affairs that can help kind of bridge this gap a little bit so that veterans can retrain and learn in a new career field. And then the second largest issue, I believe, is dealing with a lot of the wounds of war, particularly those that aren't seen. And the Department of Veterans Affairs is being flooded with a lot of these claims from veterans on, how do we deal and treat these issues. And the Department of Veterans Affairs, the Department of Defense are both kind of struggling with this issue. But I think that's where the universities, that's where nonprofits have a role to play to help kind of be the glue.
We'll pick up on these points in just a moment, but let me turn now to Deb. What do you see as the greatest challenge?
I see the acceptance of these veterans by back in their communities again as one of the greater problems. The fact is, as Brian mentioned, the wounds of war are not apparent in most situations. We're talking about PTSD, traumatic brain injuries, that sort of thing. And the stigma that goes along with those things and getting past that stigma to accept these folks back into our communities again and their family members, their children and their spouses, their parents, all of these folks are being tremendously affected by these issues also.
All part of the same story.
That's right.
Tracy, how about you?
Well, I think I have to piggyback a little bit on what Deb said because I think that all these things are great things, but I think that the biggest thing that we struggle with is the reintegration, that process of finding that normalcy again that we once knew to being, put into a different state of normalcy and that becoming our normal for a long time and then coming back and finding that we have to now redefine what normal is for us. So I think that that's very big.
You were in three different areas here, really, all very, very important. I'd like to play a clip now from a young woman who has talked to StoryCorps, who talked about her reintegration into the community. And she was very eloquent in talking about what it was like for her when she came home. And her name is Michelle Matthews. And she spoke with StoryCorps and talked about coming back into a home environment after time overseas.
For me, war became pretty simplified, and I understood war. I call it habituation. I was habituated into war. I didn't have to cook or clean or take care of my bills. I didn't have to do anything of that matter. All of that stuff was left behind, and I got used to working long hours a day, just walking somewhere to get my meals. I didn't really drive that often. I flew in helicopters. I was used to the war sounds, the helicopters, the gunshots, the mortars flying through the air. I got used to that. So coming home, my first 90 days were the honeymoon, as I say. I was happy to be home. My family was happy. There was all these things taking place. But internally, I was a mess. There was birds chirping, and I was like, these darn birds, they're keeping me awake. At night, there's church bells. I wasn't used to church bells or buses or people honking at me. People in my personal space bothered me because I was used to the 3-foot rule where you stood 3 foot in front of me, and if you came into my space, then you were my enemy. At home, you know, we kind of bunch up with each other, and it was very uncomfortable. So it took me about a year and a half to kind of readjust back to life and try to incorporate my war life with my new life, because the person I was before I went to Iraq was not the person who came home.
And that is Michelle Matthews speaking to StoryCorps. Tracy Carpenter Bond, this, I gather, is precisely what you're talking about.
It really absolutely is. Again, when you first come home, you're just excited to be home. You're looking for some pieces to pick up from where you left off that'll kind of catapult you forward. So that's perfect. And what she said about the sounds is very close to me. I haven't slept a good night without additional help since I got back.
Because you needed noise, or there was too much noise?
You know, I'm not sure if it's the different sounds or if it's the fact that I have a difficult time turning my brain off, just trying to, even now, and I've been back for some time since the end of 2010, but still trying to get my life and make it back normal.
Where were you deployed?
And actually, I always smile at that question because I actually was deployed to Landstuhl, Germany. And if you're aware of that place, that's where we bring all of our wounded warriors back to. It's a very different kind of duty, but some of the same emotional scars.
You see the very worst of what goes on the battlefield.
Yes, you do. But the flip side of that, and I'm so very blessed to have had that duty, is that while we're seeing the very worst of what's coming back, we're on the healing side. I'm a medic, and so I got a chance to encourage them and talk and pray with them. So it gave me a sense of purpose.
Also seeing the very best of medical technology and how many lives it's saving.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Ryan, you know, I think a lot of people are probably very surprised at what Michelle was expressing there.
Right.
Not having been through that, they would say, come on, did you go through the same sort of thing?
Well, I did a 7-month tour in Iraq and a year-long tour in Afghanistan, and I can totally relate to what she's referring to, just in terms of the noise and in terms of your day-to-day operations, your what you do on a daily basis. And it's funny hearing veterans say that when they come back, particularly from a deployed location, is that it takes about a year to just feel normal again in American society. I can remember coming back and thinking to myself, what are people – why are people worried about this or that, or why do they think this is such a big deal? Because in a war zone, what you think is a big deal and what your priorities are totally different. And so what Michelle said totally just rings true to me.
And Deb, I'm making an assumption here, but given what you do and the work you do with encouraging veterans to write and deal with this in a kind of a creative way, I suppose the idea is catharsis. This helps the kind of healing that we're talking about.
Most definitely. We started this in conjunction with the VA out at Jefferson Barracks and through creative writing workshops. And what happens, and I think that Tracy and Ryan will tell you, is that frequently when they come back, the last place on earth a veteran wants to be is at the VA. And young veterans just do not want to be at the VA. And so we start making these resources available to folks or to new veterans out in the community. And that's why we do this sort of healing process. You know, and it's not just for veterans. I think people who have been through other situations, cancer survivors, that sort of, you know, it is a catharsis. It is a healing process that occurs through writing, through photography, through artwork in general.
Mm-hmm. You know, I was a little surprised to start this program talking about the reintegration, but it makes so much sense once you explained, Tracy and Ryan and all of you, what's going on. I really thought the big thing was going to be dealing with the health issues. We have another clip from a gentleman by the name of Glenn Smith who appeared on NPR over the weekend. He's an Army vet, and he filed his first claims in 2012 for disability assistance. It hasn't happened yet, and here's what he said in talking to NPR.
Once I got out of the military, it was still like I was in limbo. I felt like I was in limbo like I am right now. And once I got back home to St. Louis, I've been trying to push with the VA here at St. Louis of trying to get my compensation and also trying to get therapy for my PTSD. Earlier this week, and I was told that my case wouldn't be looked at for like another year or so because they're backlogged 2 years right now.
You know, I'm speaking for myself, but I know I represent a lot of people, and I say this is an outrage that people come home after serving their country and have to wait a year or longer for some of the most basic attention. I'm sure you all feel the same way.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Right. Normally what I hear from veterans that come into our center at UMSL is about an 18-month wait just to get any sort of feedback on their disability case.
Let's take a listen to what Senator Dick Durbin had to say yesterday during a Memorial Day observance in Springfield, Missouri. He, of course, the senator from Illinois, and would be in a position, you would assume, to make things happen to change the system. Let's listen to him.
There is no excuse for people waiting months, sometimes over a year, to get a determination on their disability. We owe it to these veterans to do a much better job.
But, you know, even what they're talking about now, they're talking about maybe cutting it down to 4 months. Tracy, that's still an awful long time.
It really is. And I know you see this that kind of look on my face. And that's just because even before you get to the disability claims process, the process just to get continued medical care is unthinkable. I mean, I had a reconstructive surgery overseas. And I was just sharing with my friends that I just had my first therapy session, and my surgery was over 2 years ago, and I've been back a little over a year.
Go ahead, Deb.
2 years ago, I did a fly fishing expedition with some of the wounded warriors from the Warriors Transition Unit at Fort Leonard Wood. That's sort of how we started this program. And at that time, they were telling folks in the Warriors Transition Unit, and there are only 30 of them in on post throughout the country, they were telling folks when they came into the Warriors Transition Unit that they would be there about 30 days. Of the 14 individuals who were with me on that that fly fishing expedition, all of them had been sitting in transition, waiting to find out if they were going to be going back into military service or if they were going to transition back home again. They had been sitting there in excess of 18 months. Mm-hmm. And that's before. And so these are folks who are sitting there waiting to find out what's going to happen to them. And a lot of times what they're doing is they're sitting there waiting for their next medical appointment.
Yes.
And that's it.
I have to take a break in a moment, but Ryan, let me just ask you, is this so much different than it might have been, and perhaps you don't know, but might have been after Vietnam, after World War II, is it these long, long delays?
You know, that's a really good question. I have, because of my position, I've come into contact with some Vietnam veterans. And the sense that I get is that more what they tend to discuss is society in general and the issues that were going on within the United States, but they don't really talk much about how the VA treated them at all. So that's actually a really good question.
The Vietnam vets had a totally different set of problems, some of the same, of course, but a totally different set. I have to take a break now. We're talking about veterans and the life they face once they take off the uniform or return home following deployment overseas. My guest in studio, Deborah Marshall, Veterans Programming Coordinator for Missouri Humanities Council, Tracy Carpenter Bond, Veterans Affairs Coordinator for the St. Louis Community College District, and Ryan Barrett, Interim Director, Veterans Center, University of Missouri, St. Louis. Back to continue our conversation about some of the issues that these veterans face in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our conversation on veterans following their service and or deployment. My guests in studio are Ryan Barrett, Interim Director of Veterans Center, University of Missouri, St. Louis, Tracy Carpenter Bond, Veterans Affairs Coordinator for the St. Louis Community College, and Deborah Marshall, Veterans Programming Coordinator for Missouri Humanities Council. Ryan, I'd like to return to you in part of your statement when we began this program. You talked about the job situation. Why is it so difficult for these veterans to find jobs?
Sure. I think just as in any issue, you have a case-by-case basis. But in general, I think what you have are veterans who are coming back and they want to go into a different profession. Even if they were in a job in the military that can be applied to some sort of civilian job out there, still they may not want to continue to do that line of work. And so they have to be retrained. A lot of employers, they're, and I don't blame them. They're looking for a cookie cutter, ready to go employee that's going to start the job. Well, you're probably not going to get that with a veteran, and so there's going to have to be a period of time there where they're going to have to either retrain, learn new skills, and maybe get some other intangible support that's going to help them feel like a civilian again. So that's number one. And then number two, there is still a little bit of stigma involved with possibly some of the health issues that they may have coming into that organization.
You know, I was in the Marine Reserves, and I'll never forget, this was a long time ago, talking to a sergeant. And I said, Sarge, he'd been in there for 20 years. I said, why do you stay in the military for so long? And he said, I don't know anybody who needs a machine gunner.
Right.
in civilian life. How true. Tracy, this is where the community colleges come in, isn't it? Giving training assistance and education to these young men and women so they can find better jobs.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Especially where the community college is doing a really great job is a program came out called the Veterans Retraining Assistance Program. And it was focused towards community colleges, VOTEC institutions, and places that are in the business of giving certificate and of proficiency and specialization. And I think that that's great because, I mean, I do understand what Ryan's saying, but there are a great number of jobs in the military that you do and that when you come back home, you necessarily are equipped to jump right in and do a job you've been doing for, I don't know, in my case, 20 years. But the problem becomes they don't have the paper credentials to accompany that, which gives that employer the confidence that you know what you're doing. And so that's where the community college comes in. And because of the programs that they have, it doesn't take 4 years to do it, of course. The Veterans Retraining Program is geared towards certificates of specialization and proficiency. And they can be 6, 8, 9 months a year long. So it gives veterans a chance to get those credentialing papers that are necessary in a civilian industry, in a civilian environment, that in the military, once I put you through training, and this is your MOS or your NEC, I already know that you're equipped to do that job.
And they also come back with leadership and discipline skills that can be useful in any workplace.
Oh, absolutely.
That should not be minimized.
Yes.
Deb Marshall, what I hear is that a lot of employers are afraid of, quote, damaged goods, that they might be hiring somebody who does have a problem. You can't see the problem because it's up in the, you know, between the ears. Do you see it this way? Are you confronted by this with the folks you deal with?
Absolutely, because it's not only the fact that There are employers who feel that they're getting broken individuals because of things like suicide attempts and PTSD and just communication issues that many veterans have. They already have these kind of obstacles sitting before them when they're looking for jobs.
You know, I hear you mentioned suicide issues, that 22 vets a day are killing themselves.
Absolutely. It's astounding. And, you know, my nephew is in the Navy, and when he was in training, before he got out of naval training, already six people had committed suicide before they even graduated.
Wow.
And some of this, I suppose, relates back to what we were talking about earlier, and that is that they need medical attention, but they have to wait forever to get it, and I guess can get pretty despondent during a time frame like that.
I think it's a matter of despondency, and it's a matter of realizing that what you think you're going to be going into is not what you got.
Mm-hmm. I think another piece of that whole suicide thing, and it often causes me to ponder it, is something that we kind of alluded to before, is that veterans are coming out of a situation of even sometimes empowerment, but intense purpose, making a difference, responsibilities, all these wonderful things, and you come back and you're not doing that. You quickly lose your sense of purpose. And I laugh. I say I'm an old salty and rough bird. So I'm, you know, I think I'm pretty resilient. But even those first 6 months that I got back, I found myself spiraling down. And I just literally looked in the mirror and said, if you don't do something now, you'll be a statistic. But it was because my days overseas were so busy with my mission, with the people that I was trying to care for, the people that worked with me. Under me, the people that I worked for, then to come home and almost have a situation where you feel useless. And if somebody doesn't recognize that in you or be very purposeful about giving you a new purpose and a new mission, then you necessarily spiral down. And then by the time those around you see it, you can't reach their hand anymore.
That's one of the reasons we look at writing as a means of giving someone purpose. It's not only to establish goals, because it's one of the things that we do when we do our workshops, and we give you immediate goals that you can attain. We also give you an opportunity to share what's on your mind, and whether it be with other individuals who are in situations just like you or with people who really don't have an understanding of what you're going through. And so it becomes a matter of communicating, you know, learning communication skills, as well as really serving as a life preserver in some cases.
Absolutely.
Right. Mm-hmm. If there's anything to add to that particular part of our narrative, shall I move along to another issue that is very much in the news these days, which is the sexual harassment, sexual assault. Both President Obama and Defense Secretary Hagel over the weekend, speaking to the military academies, addressed this issue. I'll start with you, Tracy. What did you think of what they had to say and about this issue in general?
Well, I do understand it. And the reason that I understand it is, you know, in tandem with me being a medic, I'm what they call a biomedical engineering technician, which means I go in and I install and repair hospital equipment. It's very male intensive. And what I found myself doing, I mean, many times even throughout my 20-year career, I found that I was either one of two or three or the only female in that environment. And really what I found myself doing is almost assimilating. I mean, putting on this really gruff exterior, you know, adding a few colorful curse words to my vocabulary and just trying to come in saying, look, I know I'm a woman, but, you know, if you cross me, you know, I'm just as my wrath can be just as bad as any guy. And I found that to be the place where I lived. And so I didn't quite have that kind of experience, but I do understand it.
You were aware. You had to
I was
change.
Very aware.
You had to become a different person because Absolutely. You knew it was out there. Ryan, any thoughts from you on this sexual assault problem?
Right. I think that it's definitely something that that needs to be addressed, and it's obviously a problem. And going back to what Tracy is talking about, there's a cultural issue there that has to be somehow changed. It's really unfortunate because when I was in the military, I didn't really see any sexual harassment myself. I didn't witness it. And I felt that the military tends to be very good at, regardless of any sort of issues, we all come together and we complete the mission. Well, when sexual harassment, sexual assault is systematic, that's going to undermine that very much so.
And Deb, how about you? How do you see this the fallout from this?
Well, what happens in our situation, once again, back to the workshops, many times we will have men and women, most of the time we have men and women combined in this situation, and you find in the workshop situation. And what we end up finding is that the females are reluctant to express themselves because they feel that they are in another situation, just like the one that they want to communicate about, because they have been victims of rape or sexual harassment. And I think it's a situation that has gone without attention for a long, long time, and it's time that we pay attention to what these ladies have to say.
We have another clip I'd like to play now from the StoryCorps collection that was done here, and once again we'll turn to Michelle Matthews, who has written a book, by the way, called Reentry, Surviving Life After War. But she was sexually harassed during her time in service in this country by her commander. And from the way I understand the story, that there was a court-martial of some sort, a disciplinary hearing of some sort, in which the ultimate ruling was in her favor, and he, if I remember correctly, was demoted. But as soon as this was over and she basically is given a clean slate, she next thing she knew, she was off to Kuwait and the Middle East. Here's her comment.
I felt so isolated. I remember looking out the window and was like, dear God, what else do I have to do in order for this to just be over? You know? Yeah. And it ended in my favor. But it didn't stop there because there was no time to process, because all I did was move from there to the war zone. There was no downtime for me to process and do counseling or any of that. It was just like I was done. He got in trouble, and then 2 weeks later, I was in Kuwait, and then I was in Iraq. And then it didn't end there because he appealed it, and then they were going to make me come back to the States to testify again. And finally somebody, I guess, talked some sense into him, and it didn't happen, so the case was closed.
All right. That, once again, is Michelle Matthews. I didn't realize until a moment ago, Deb, that you did the interview with Michelle.
Yes, I did.
Yeah.
Yes, I did. And one of the things I want to add about Michelle having come forward and revealed this information and writing the book afterwards, which she will tell you was very cathartic for her. But there have been people, because this was a very popular commander who was court-martialed ultimately. And Michelle caught some of the downdraft from that situation. And that's one of the things that women fear, yes, is the repercussions of having mm-hmm. come forward.
We hear this again and again. I mean, we've been hearing it for many, many months now with regard to going on. And then two ranking officers who were charged in their various services with being responsible for dealing with this problem wind up facing charges themselves. It's incredible.
Yeah, it really is. As I was listening to her talk, I was thinking that's where I found that the system is really kind of flawed, in that many times, you know, I've been to disciplinary boards and things before for folks that worked for me, and you were being kind of, you know, it's still all your own peers, so to speak. So you're just being, you know, the folks that are making the decisions and the rulings about the accused are the peers and the colleagues of that individual. And so many times what I would see is that even if there was a ruling in their favor, you know, it didn't hold a lot of weight. Maybe after everything dies down, things are kind of back to what they were before. And so I really salute those women that come forward.
Ryan, what kind of pressure does this put on the men in uniform? They see and hear of this going on around them, and yet every man in uniform is potentially a suspect, if you will,
right,
that the women that the men are working for, you know, might pull back. And this is where teamwork is so important, where working together is vital for the success of any mission.
Right. And I think that's where, you know, even aside from male-female issues, where race comes into play, where ethnicity comes into play, you have to put all of that aside and recognize that you're all team members, and you don't, you know, regardless of your background, that you're working together to complete a mission, and that's it. And you've just got to be a professional. It's just that simple, really.
You would think it would be a relatively easy issue to deal with in the sense that discipline should be tough and rapid, but it doesn't seem to work that way.
No, not necessarily.
Well, perhaps it will. I have to take another break, and we'll come back and continue our conversation. We're talking about life after deployment, life after the service for servicemen and women. We'll continue that conversation, and of course, we want to bring you, our listeners, into the discussion. Give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll also take a tweet at STL on air. Back in just a moment, this is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again. Welcome back to our conversation about veterans issues. With me in studio, Tracy Carpenter-Bond, Veterans Affairs Coordinator for the St. Louis Community College, Deborah Marshall, Veterans Programming Coordinator, Missouri Humanities Council, and Ryan Barrett, Interim Director of the Veterans Center at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. Anyone have something they'd like to say before I go to the phones? Anything that's been left out? Okay, let's pick it up with Darcella calling from St. Louis. Thank you for waiting. You're on the air.
Oh, no problem. This is Darcella Craven. I'm with the Veterans Business Resource Center. And I first want to say thank you to Tracy and the rest of your guests for the programs that they're putting together for military. I'm an Army veteran myself, and I remember getting out, and there was just nothing back in the 90s. So kudos to you all. Thank you. The thing that we find is also very interesting. So I wanted to ask them quickly if they understand about the new TAP program. The military, I think, is in DOD is finally listening when people are giving them, you know, responses back saying it's hard to transition. And so they have a new TAP program that emphasizes four different areas for military when they transition out, and that is employment, education, entrepreneurship, and apprenticeship. And I wondered if they were familiar with that, if they could talk a little bit about giving military personnel options now that they didn't have before. Obviously, when they do the entrepreneurship one, we go in and give them a two-day assessment of a business idea. But wanted to know if they could talk a little bit more about how they can transition out better.
Okay, thank you so much for the call, Darcella. Who'd like to pick that up? Ryan?
Well, as someone who went through TAP not that long ago, I separated from active duty back in November 2011. So I did my TAP probably September of that year. You know, I got to say, none of these these four E's that were just brought up were really described in detail to us. I think the Department of Defense has a lot of improvement. There's a lot of improvement to be made in how it transitions active duty military out into the civilian world.
Mm-hmm. Thoughts on that, Tracy?
Yes, I think, Ryan, that you're right. But the other piece of that is I think I remember going through TAPS and coming back from a deployment, you know, all that information in that short period of time, I really wasn't mentally there. And so I was still adjusting to time changes and all of that. So what I think is even better, and we said we're going to just keep saying it, is you can't teach a warrior to transition out of something that may have lasted 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years in 3 days. It's just not possible. I think it's a process that needs to start a lot sooner.
Is all of that, what is TAP the acronym for again?
What is It's funny we laugh because we live so much in the acronym world.
We use so many acronyms
world.
We forget them. Right.
Okay, well, let's move away from that for a moment. What I wanted to get to, and Deb, I'll start with you on this. You know, in the situation for the last decade, it has involved multiple deployments. How does this exacerbate the situation?
Well, you come home and you try to go back to your life, and you're just getting into, you know, back into whatever sense of normalcy you might find in civilian life, and you're being deployed again. And how do you continue a relationship? You know, relationships with your children. How do you continue your employment situation? You know, and all those things that occur in a year's time, and you drop it and you come back and, you know, it's all there again, and you drop it again and you're deployed and you come back again, and God, what an awful situation.
Just when some of the damage is being repaired, you find yourself back in harm's
way. That's exactly right.
Certainly, absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, and by the way, that TAP is the Transition Assistance Program.
Okay. Thanks.
We said a thing.
While we're in the process of clarification, I made a mistake a few moments ago when I said that Dick Durbin was speaking in Springfield, Missouri yesterday, Memorial Day. In deference to his constituents in Illinois, I should point out he was speaking in Springfield, Illinois. So correction made, and I hope duly noted. Back to the phones. Sheila in University City, you're next. Go ahead. Sheila, are you? No, Sheila's not there. Ellen and Kirkwood, we'll bring you on. Go ahead.
Hello, good morning. I'm calling because I worked at a VA hospital in the late 1970s, and I saw many veterans from World War II and Korea, and very, very few who had been involved in Vietnam. The word was not official, but the word was that veterans from involved in Vietnam just got very few health benefits, and that's why they were not there. So I was wondering if that was true, and that's it. So thank you. I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay. I'm not sure we have the expertise at the table to answer that question, unfortunately.
Yeah. I mean, I can speak a little bit to the post-9/11 era veterans, but as far as the health care that the Vietnam era vets got, I'm honestly not sure.
I will say that the workshops that we do out at the VA at Jefferson Barracks, it's interesting that we are seeing more Vietnam vets participating in those workshops, because it's almost like the post-9/11 veterans have, and the situations that we're dealing with them, have given them permission to seek help, you know, if they've served in Vietnam.
We have a call from St. Louis for Mike, who will deal with the Vietnam situation, I believe. Mike, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, I'm a Vietnam vet, and when I came back, I set up a goal to go to school, and several of my peers did the same thing. We actually worked full-time, went to school part-time using the GI Bill, and that helped a lot as far as our transition by having that focused goal that we were working on and progressing through that. I was wondering if you're looking at using the GI Bill and helping those that are that have the interest to get back to school and even part-time, and try to use that as a way of adjusting and assimilating.
Thanks, Mike. Well, Tracy, that sounds like the ball would be in your court here.
Yes. Thank you for calling. I think that the government and the Department of Labor and those entities that are necessary are really looking at that. I mentioned the Veterans Retraining Assistance Program. It was put in place to speak to 35 to 60, which encompasses our Vietnam-era vets. We have a lot of them in that program, St. Louis Community College, giving them an opportunity. And I think that they're coming forward. I have heard them say, because we have so many of them, that they're saying, you know, about time that somebody thought about us, the post-Vietnam-era veterans. So we feel like this is our second chance. And so we've done that we've employed that program at our college, and you know, it's working. There are some other things that probably need to go with it. But I'm just so glad that I'm there to be able to service them.
And you were nodding, Deb, as you were listening to that caller.
Absolutely, because it is a matter of a lot of post-Vietnam veterans going back through writing programs. I found since through our program, and they're telling their stories now, and they're going, you know, this is something I can do. Mm-hmm. I may, you know, and they're talking about some of their stories sitting on the shelves for 35 years or 30 years, mm-hmm. and now all of a sudden they're doing this and they're publishing, and it's like they've found their voice now.
Yeah. It sounds like a great release. You know, again, going back to the StoryCorps time in St. Louis and gathering stories from veterans here, while we're talking about Vietnam, let me take a moment to bring in a piece from Tim Ema, I believe is the way he pronounces his name. He is an older vet, and I think he went in. You're nodding your head. Do I have this right, Deb? He's 61 now, I believe, but he was deployed when he was in his 50s. Is that correct?
That's correct. He served in Vietnam, and he served in Iraq both.
Well, let's listen to him talk about the changes that he saw from one to the other.
Well, the military had to learn. They had to learn because of the current issues in society. They had to learn how to deal with a lot of the fact that you have women in the military and women in positions of power in the military. And the idea of sexual harassment, the things that in the workplace issues, those are things that have permeated within the military also. And the military has had to change with those cultural changes.
Right.
So that's, you know, those are things that they learned how to deal with. And I guess if you want to call it more compassionate, yeah, I guess they are more compassionate to that. They still require you to follow protocol and procedure, and there is a tradition there. But beyond that, they are more compassionate, I think. My unit was probably out of 100 people-ish, we were probably 70-80% women. And so most of our commanders were women, and they knew how to do the job, and they also knew how to be the nurses and medics that needed to be in charge of patient care. So they brought the marrying of two different worlds at that point, the medical side, plus the fact that their gender acted as a strength rather than a weakness, I felt.
Ryan, I understand you know Tim.
Yes.
Is that correct?
That is correct.
He sounds like quite a guy. If my information is correct, he's 61 and going for his PhD. He's a little different.
He's still going strong. He's been in the military as a reservist, working in various medical units, and is also was in public education for a very long time, and is now back at UMSL working on his PhD.
All right. Well, good for him. You expressed some surprise just with your expression, Tracy, when he said that 80% of his unit were women, but he was a medic, I guess, in the medical corps, which you're familiar with.
So when he said 80%, I thought, wow, that's cool. Where's that place? But then, you know, when I realized he was with the medical unit, that is necessarily the case because, you know, we have the medics, nurses, a nurse anesthetist. So the medical unit, I think they have the biggest diversity in, you know, in gender as well as others, because many times as part of a medical unit, like the one I was a part of, we have all of our medical specialists, but we do still have others. So it's kind of a unique place.
Yeah. By the way, these interviews were conducted at the University of Missouri-St. Louis and also at the Regional Arts Commission, from what I understand. There are a number of them, and I guess we'll be hearing them as time goes by from the folks at StoryCorps. Let's take another call. Sheila has called back, and thank you for doing so, Sheila. Go ahead. Sorry to keep you waiting again.
Hi, thanks for giving me another chance. I have a general question and a specific example with Agent Orange that's related to the question. First, I want to say I think it's disgraceful that the Congress, the U.S. Congress, many of whom voted enthusiastically for the Iraq War, are now saying they don't have enough money for some basic veterans programs for the returning soldiers. And that's related to my question. I'm not even quite sure what the question is. It's something about how Congress and other government agencies and departments deal with returning veterans. But with respect to Agent Orange, that's been over 40 years ago that it was starting to be used in Vietnam. And about 25 years ago, I was doing some temp work, and I was offered a job at Monsanto, a long-term job there. And the doctor who interviewed me was satisfied with my credentials. I said, well, what kind of project are you working on? He said, well, I'm helping to gather information to defend Monsanto against the Agent Orange claims from Vietnam. And I was shocked. I was shocked. I don't know why I should have been. But I said, there's no way I'm going to participate in that. Well, I'm looking at the history of Agent Orange and so on online, and it says it was in 1999 that Congress enacted an Agent Orange Act, giving the Department of Veterans Affairs authority, apparently for the first time, to look at certain medical conditions as a possible connection with Agent Orange. And I want to know, why did it take so darn long? And why doesn't the government think about supporting the returning vets when they're so eager to send them to war?
Sheila, thanks for the call. Again, unless someone here wants to respond to why it took Congress so long, you know, we can conjecture as much as we want. anybody want it?
I think just about every American is wondering why Congress takes so long to do anything. Yeah. I don't want to specifically address the Agent Orange issue. That's kind of out of my area of expertise. But going back to the more general comment about Congress deciding to go to war and then maybe being a little slow to take care of the veterans when they come back, I've heard this over and over again. You know, if you're going to send men and women off to war, also make sure that you put aside the resources to take care of them when they come back home.
So. Well, that's part of the whole problem with going in. We never had an exit strategy at all. Many people would argue that we did not. And this is part of that, dealing with the fallout from it. We only have a couple of minutes left, and I want to give each of you a chance to do a commercial about the kind of services that you provide. I know, Deb, you've got a contest coming up and that you've put out a book that is a compilation of stories from folks that you're dealing with. Is that correct?
Yes. We have put out Proud to Be Writing by American Warriors, Volume 1, in 2012, and we are still seeking calls for submission in a contest or through a contest for not only Missouri veterans and family members, but also veterans and family members from around the country. This ends July 1st.
And this is from your other organization?
Well, actually, this is through the Missouri Humanities Council in collaboration with the Warriors Arts Alliance, and it's published by Southeast Missouri State University.
Okay, I'll let folks know that we have a link to your Warriors group.
Okay.
Website on our website, stlpublicradio.org. They
Great.
Can get more information. The contest until July 1st, is that
That's correct.
Correct.
And okay. And the new Volume 2 will be out on Veterans Day of this year.
Right. So we can contact you through our website.
Absolutely.
At STL Public Radio.
Thank
Ryan,
you.
In a minute or less, can you tell us the kinds of things that you can help people with at your center?
Sure. The UMSL Veterans Center is really open to all vets. We you know, service any veteran, but particularly our best resources are for students who are attending UMSL. We provide information on benefits, particularly health care benefits and education benefits. So if anyone would like to reach out to us, we are located at 211 Clark Hall. That's UMSL's main campus, 211 Clark Hall. Our phone number is 314-516-5705, or you can reach us at veteransoffice@umsl.edu.
Thanks much, and we will put that information on our website a little bit later in the day. Thanks, Ryan. Okay, Tracy, last but certainly not least.
Well, thank you. I think St. Louis Community College has done an awesome job in reaching out for veterans, even evidenced by the new position that I hold. And so we have lots of programs that I think are geared toward the veteran learner, the adult learner, the experienced learner. And so I'm asking, if you're out there and you're a veteran, I know that sometimes it seems like you don't quite know where to grab hold. But if you know that school's in your future, or maybe you're not quite sure where you want to go with that, then I ask you to reach out to St. Louis Community College. We have some great programs with our veterans retraining program. We have the Center for Workforce Innovation that has some wonderful opportunities that we're partnering with military. Come out and see us. You can look at us on the web. We're at www.stlcc.edu/veterans. My information is there and my door is open.
And we will put a link to that website on our website, stlpublicradio.org. That is Tracy Carpenter-Bond. Thank you so much for being with us, Tracy. Nice to meet you. Deborah Marshall, thank you for being with us. Good luck with your program. And Ryan Barrett, same to you.
Thank you.
I hope you have much success, and I hope people think a little bit more about our veterans following this discussion than they might have otherwise. Thank you all once again.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about the use of solar energy. Is it reaching its potential? Have we reached a tipping point, perhaps? We'll find out. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.